I'd like to call the Higher Education Conference Committee to order. This afternoon, we'll be taking testimony regarding the bills and general higher education information. We will just go ahead and start then. I've got a list here, and I understand there may be one or two additions or a little bit of change of order, but we'll just go ahead and start with the first on the list, and we have Robert Brunix, the president of the University of Minnesota. Please, Dr. Brunix.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Pleased to have this opportunity for a few moments to talk about the University of Minnesota. I sort of like to start with a short declarative statement that as I leave my position, I must say I'm deeply proud of the accomplishments and stewardship of the University of Minnesota. But I'm also obviously quite concerned not only about the condition of the state's economy, but the prospects of deep budget reductions. In my 9 years of tenure as president, I've witnessed and shepherded deep budget reductions in 2003, 2004, 2010, 2011, and now for the next biennium, 2012 to 2013. Due to careful planning and responsible management, I believe we have consistently balanced our budget and at the same time worked diligently to improve academic quality, services, and I would add productivity. In fact, the university today is regarded as one of the best, most productive universities in America. In previous testimony, I've shared the university's strong contribution to Minnesota's economy and quality of life. We graduate approximately 14,000 students, mostly with advanced and technical degrees at the University of Minnesota, and a recently commissioned economic impact study. We documented that we produce approximately $8.6 billion of statewide economic impact, over $13 for every dollar invested in the state of Minnesota, and directly and indirectly produced nearly 80,000 jobs in Minnesota's economy. I've also expressed concern that these deep reductions, $100 million or more per year, will permanently erode our ability to deliver on our unique mission of world-class educational opportunities and innovation through research and discovery. Research and discovery activities of the University of Minnesota brought in $823 million just in this past year alone, creating an estimated number of 17,000 jobs. My main point is we expect to be part of the solution, but the cut proposed for fiscal 2012, in my judgment, is way too big, especially on the heels of $190 million that was reduced from the university's state resources in this current biennium. This reduction, if enacted, would take the university back to 1998 levels of state funding. That said, I want to be clear that we believe that we have to be a part of the state solution. This is a cut I will have to deal with on my watch, even though I have just 2 months to go. And I want to assure members of the committee we've been working on these issues for more than 2 years. We're obviously focused on driving cut down costs at the University of Minnesota, and we really focused on our largest cost, which is the funding and employment of the people who work at the University of Minnesota. I announced very, very early in the new fiscal year that we could expect a wage freeze, wage and salary freeze in fiscal 2012. Subject to the normal requirements of collective bargaining. I announced for the third time in my tenure an early retirement incentive that produced great results just a few years ago. I have announced my intention to take forward a recommendation to increase the retirement contributions for new academic employees, approximately 7,000 to 8,000 of our pretty close to 9,000 of our employees are in this category. I'm calling for increased premium costs and co-pays for employees to drive down the health care cost increase increases, and we have found ways to save nearly $3 million a year by restructuring the administration of the university's health program. We're also aggressively implementing additional long-term cost reductions across all of our operations, including capital investment and operating costs. We may decommission as much as 200,000 assignable square feet of space across the state of Minnesota in this year alone. We've reduced energy costs at a very challenging time. Technology costs and procurement costs have gone down by nearly $6.5 million in this year alone. We have our cost increases to deal with at the same time. We'll balance the budget using both revenue and relying probably largely on tuition and internal cuts and adjustments. And I want to talk, just make a couple of comments about how we approach our approaching this budget and how we've approached previous challenges. We've always directed our academic and support units across the University of Minnesota system to make differential reductions, but we have always taken about two-thirds of the required reductions in reduced state support by reducing units and cost and increasing productivity. And we've tried to rely to a much lesser extent on raising tuition, and we will do that again this time. We expect to resolve no more than about one-third of the challenge that will await us through increases in tuition. And I'm very hopeful that we can keep the tuition increases for resident undergraduate students at the University of Minnesota, anticipating the reductions that I hope can be mitigated somewhat to about 5%. And, of course, with need-based aid, we've been able successfully in the last 9 years to keep the average increase, net price increase, at about 3.5% a year, and that will happen again this year. Finally, I'm really concerned about language banning specific types of research in the bills that you have before you. I think this potentially can represent a real threat to maintaining our best researchers and recruiting the talent we need to keep the university strong for the future. It clearly can dampen our prospects to be competitive with respect to external funding. I think ultimately this would reduce our opportunities to prevent and cure disease, spark innovation, and create jobs in Minnesota's economy. This will likely be the last time that I testify before you as president of our great university, and so I'd like to end on a somewhat more positive note. I want to offer my sincere thanks to you and other members of the legislature for all that we've achieved together in these last 9 years. This state has made very strong capital investment in facilities and campuses of the University of Minnesota on a statewide basis, including the Biomedical Discovery District, an on-campus stadium, science classroom buildings on at least three campuses, and many other investments to restore and maintain the quality of our physical infrastructure and laboratories. Together, we've transformed the university by substantially improving academic quality, productivity, and research to advance Minnesota's economy and quality of life, and we simply could not have done it without some strong support from the Minnesota legislature and the citizens of our state. State funding is absolutely essential to the strength and quality of the University of Minnesota, and I'm here to ask you to continue to support our mission on behalf of the state and its citizens, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or take comments at this time.
Are there any comments or questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
All right, good. Thank you.
Appreciate your information. Next on the list, we have Chancellor McCormick and Ms. King from the Minsky system. Thank you very much. Welcome. Whenever you're ready.
Yes. Good afternoon and to all of you. And thank you for the opportunity to say a few words to the conference committee as you undertake the work on the higher education report that you all have to make. Maybe I'll have an opportunity to come before you again, so I'm not going to say that as we work through these difficult times. We really appreciate the attention the House and the Senate, the Education Committees, have given to our interests and the respective bills which you have developed. We know that you've heard our concerns about the negative trends in state support for accessible public higher education in Minnesota these past 10 years. We also know that you and your colleagues value and support the educational services provided by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to over 400,000 Minnesota citizens every year across the state. We have received very positive feedback from you and your colleagues about this service in quality, accessibility, responsiveness to the marketplace, and the relevance to Minnesota's economic development in the cities, towns across the region. All parties to the state budget process acknowledge a role in the budget balancing work now underway in this building. We have not tried to shrink that role to avoid the consequences. We do ask that you provide us with as much flexibility as possible so that we have all of the tools to preserve services as we are reducing budgets. Our Board of Trustees, our presidents, students, faculty, and staff have been grappling with the fiscal challenge we face for several years. Our presidents have held hundreds of conversations around the state with hundreds of people to talk about the students' value and what our communities and their employers need. The presidents are now struggling with the choices they have to make to preserve these priorities. We had the opportunity to tell you some of that at an earlier time. The message we get back from the presidents is simple. Our campuses need flexibility in planning for tuition. Please don't establish tuition in the law. The Board of Trustees and I share the commitment to increasing tuition by no more than 5% each year of the biennium. The 5% level has been in the planning parameters for our campus. We ask that you do what you can to minimize budget cuts. The citizens of Minnesota, you can check the numbers, have flocked to our colleges and universities in record-setting pace. They want our services. We want to be able to provide the education that they seek. There are three language issues that I would ask you not to include in the final bill. We would urge you not to adopt the language directing the board regarding transformational initiatives. Languages like this micromanages the work of the Board of Trustees. The House report also includes language regarding credit transfer. We are already doing the work that language addresses. Alternate language has been provided committee staff that we hope you will be able to consider and find acceptable. There's one other section of the House bill that we would hope you will not adopt. It was rejected by the committee, and we do not support it. The language concerns yet another study of the system and the Chancellor's Office. Recall the Office of the Legislative Auditor just completed a study for you in this last year with, I think, quite positive results. We don't think another one is necessary and hope you will reject the language. Finally, we ask you to allow the Board of Trustees to negotiate contracts and salaries. Our employees are our greatest resource. They are critical partners to the work that we do. We would ask that you protect the board's ability to manage these relationships. Our board has a firm hand on our financial condition and is prepared to provide leadership to the negotiating process. We hope you will not support the language directing this work in the House Committee report. The students and the institutions that comprise the Minnesota State College and Universities are a national success story. We offer high quality, affordable education to the people of Minnesota. We ask you to help in protecting and preserving this public asset in the years ahead. Senate bill provides more support and more flexibility. Thank you again for the time today, and we certainly have staff here and to respond to any questions that you might have. But thank you for this opportunity to come before you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Ms. King, did you have something you wanted? You were just here for questions. So. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have on the list Ted Tollefson. Thank you for joining us. Whenever you're ready, just identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Reverend Ted Tollefson. I have served as a Unitarian Universalist minister in Minnesota and Wisconsin for 30 years. And for 17 years, I've had the privilege of teaching psychology at Metro State University. So I'm going to attempt to keep this on the secular side, but count on you to restrain me if you hear an altar call coming your way. I've taught at Metro State because the pay is fair, the benefits are modest for community faculty, but that's not really why I teach. I teach because I support the mission of the state university system as I have come to understand it, and that is to provide a high-quality, low-cost education so our students can graduate to a better life. And I suspect that many of you have attended our state university system or University of Minnesota. You are living proof that it works. So I have three questions and one statement. The first question is, how can we grow an economy that is increasingly dependent upon higher education by underfunding higher education? My guess is we can't do that. I think it was Mark Twain who said you can try feeding your dog his own tail, but after the first bite you have difficulty. And it's because it's interconnected, and I suppose that's my thesis, that higher education and the economy in an information-based society are inextricably connected. If you investigate almost any business in the state, my guess is you will discover it has been radically transformed by technology and ideas that did not exist 20 years ago. My wife owns a small independent used bookstore near University of Minnesota. When they started, all the books they sold and quite a few they didn't walked out the front door. Now, after beginning to move into internet-based sales, half the books are sold over the internet. If we had not invested in that technology and the people who make it work and the equipment 15 years ago, we wouldn't be in business anymore. And if you look both nationally and regionally at those that are feel the impact most strongly in a recession, it tends to be people who have a high school education or less. And if you look at our state economy 7 years from now, you'll find that 70% of the jobs will require higher education. So my guess is higher education and our current and future economy are inextricably connected. Second point is a statement. In balancing any budget, we need to look at the big picture, and that includes expenses, investments, and income. Many of you have called our attention to the fact that higher education is an expense, and that is appropriate and necessary. I am here today to remind you that higher education is also an investment in a better life for Minnesota and its citizens. If we do not invest today in our educational infrastructure, where will the better students and the better jobs go 5 to 7 years from now? We also need to look at the income side of the ledger. Many of the current budget proposals ask very little additional help of our most prosperous citizens. I believe this is a tragic mistake. If you think that the top 2 or 3% of our citizens based on income lack generosity, look again at the names on our parks, arenas, chapels, concert halls, and charitable foundations. Many of us are of our most prosperous families were steeped in an ethic of service and generosity. Why expect so little of them? Why not look for generosity? You might find it. Finally, we need to be willing to ask, what is required from us who have been so abundantly blessed? All of us in this room were given the gift of life, not because we deserved it, but because of countless acts of love. Many of us in this room have received a second gift, a high-quality, low-cost college education that was generously subsidized by the citizens of Minnesota, scholarships, our own sweat equity, and family savings. Some of us in this room have received a third gift, perhaps from a high school teacher or principal, a college professor or mentor, from an inspiring political leader, a prophet, or a carpenter. That was the gift of a second chance, a chance to begin again. What will you do with the gifts and responsibilities entrusted to your care? I hope that you will be generous with your gifts and mindful of your responsibilities, as the past generations have labored that you might occupy the seat in which you find yourself today. Let us be generous with the students of tomorrow and the institutions of higher education, however imperfect, which prepare them for a better life. Amen. And if you have comments or questions, I'd be happy to take those. We will not be taking up an offering this afternoon.
Comments from the committee? Comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Next on our list, we've got Minnesota State College faculty, Kevin Lindstrom. Thank you. Whenever you're ready, just identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Lindstrom. I'm the Technical Vice President for the Minnesota State College faculty. MSCF represents approximately 5,000 faculty at the two-year Minsku colleges across the state, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. During this legislative session, MSCF has attempted to deliver a message centered on the theme of who we are and what we do. We believe strongly in the value of what happens in our classrooms, labs, counseling offices, and libraries every day. We hope our positive, proactive, informative message has reached you. While we prefer to deliver a message focused on the positive, we would be remiss if we didn't express concerns about the impacts of the proposed cuts to our funding that you're considering. Today, I'd like to briefly outline five such concerns. First, we're concerned about how these cuts would impact access. At a time when there's greater demand than ever for public higher education, cuts of this magnitude will mean reduced offerings. We know that technical programs are expensive to deliver. We know that services to at-risk students are expensive to deliver. We know that system contraction talks will be inevitable. We're very concerned about what and who gets left behind in those discussions. Second, we're concerned about how these cuts would impact quality. There's a point where do more with less becomes do less with less. This is that point. Any fat that may have existed in the system was eliminated through previous cuts and unallotments. Third, we're concerned about how these cuts would impact the communities we serve. We know that our colleges are vital cogs in local economies. If you cut programs, local business needs aren't met. If you cut jobs at colleges, that's less money being spent in local communities. If public employees pay an additional $500 per month for insurance premiums and deductibles, as has been proposed in another committee, a community with 200 state employees loses over $1 million a year in potential local spending. Fourth, we're concerned about the impact of these cuts on morale. If you continually tell someone that who they are and what they do has diminished value, eventually they're going to believe it. We represent good people who do good things that change lives every day while simply attempting to earn a decent middle-class living. We didn't cause this financial crisis, and frankly, we're struggling to understand why we should bear a disproportionate burden in the solution. Finally, we're concerned that these cuts will force bad decisions. You've heard testimony from campus presidents stating that they will have no choice but to cut healthy programs simply as a means of cutting costs. That's the beginning of a downward spiral that's incredibly dangerous and very difficult to reverse. As such, the impacts of these cuts would be felt far beyond this biennium. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Thank you for being here today. Appreciate it. We have Dr. Kathleen Mackin and Dr. Angela Fryer, both from the United Family Medical or Medicine Residency Program. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. Whenever you're ready, just identify yourselves for the
sure.
record.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon to everyone. Madam Chairwoman, thank you, and members of the conference committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Mackin. I'm a family medicine physician, and I direct the residency at United Family Medicine Residency Program, which is located in St. Paul on West 7th Street and is a community health center as well. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with everyone today. I'm just going to briefly tell you about our program and then have Dr. Fryer speak to her story. The program was founded in 1992 and has a very strong record of training and retaining quality primary care physicians in the state of Minnesota. We have always been fortunate to have the highest level of accreditation from the Graduate Medical Education National Accrediting Body. We do, in addition to training competent family medicine physicians, follow a community-oriented primary care model so that our physicians as residents also learn to address social and environmental causes of illness and health within a community and to partner with the community to be healthier. From 1996 with our first graduates to the present, excluding this year, we have graduated 89 physicians, of whom I am especially proud to report here that 80% of our graduates stay in Minnesota, with two-thirds in rural and urban underserved communities. I myself have had the privilege of being a family physician for, I'm going to be afraid to say this, but more than 34 years. I'm extremely encouraged by family medicine in and its future. In June, we will graduate an additional group of six residents. Our residents, and I have maps if people would like, I can pass those out, work in a variety of places in the state, to include Ortonville, Sauk Center, Little Falls, Grand Rapids, Mora, Winona, North Branch, to name some. And our residents come from the University of Minnesota, University of Iowa, University of Wisconsin, University of North Dakota, as well as people coming home from places like Brown, Dartmouth, etc. We also can report, and this is very good news, I think, for the state and all states, that interest by medical students in family practice medicine is increasing, and we really strongly believe that it's very important for us to continue to do our work so that we can contribute to the health and stability of urban, rural, and underserved communities. We ask that you take into consideration the support of the Senate position regarding funding for our program. And with that said, thank you for the privilege of being here. I think anyone that I know that does family medicine feels very privileged to do the work in the state, and we really want to keep the state and improve the state's health as much as we can. Minnesota has a lot to be proud of in terms of its primary health care, and we really value the opportunity and the responsibility of continuing to provide high-quality primary health care. I will thank you so much. I will now turn it over to Dr. Fryer to tell her story and to illustrate the power of a family doc in community and within our program. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fryer.
Hi, my name is Angela Fryer. I'm a product of the state. I'm from Red Wing, Minnesota. And being the youngest of five, kind of fled the coop for undergrad and went to Virginia, but returned here after 3 years of service in the Peace Corps in Cameroon. Returned to Minnesota very eagerly to go to medical school, as it was a clear choice for me given the quality of our education here. As was it a very clear choice for me to stay in Minnesota to pursue a family medicine residency program. I will say that I'm a National Health Service Corps scholar, and so entering medical school knew that I wanted to serve in a either urban or rural underserved community. And so the focus that we have at United Family Medicine was a very easy choice for me. And so I have completed my 3 years of residency and actually graduated this past spring, but our residency program has piloted a program, I believe the first in the state, for a fourth year of mastery program. I had decided that I wanted to work with the Indian Health Services program to pay back my scholarship, and as I'm sure some people know, there is a lack of obstetrical care on some reservations due to the lack of ability to recruit OB-GYN physicians. And so I have pursued a fourth year of mastery in obstetrics, getting trained in C-sections and other surgical obstetrical procedures, so I will be able to carry that with me when I pay back my scholarship with the Indian Health Services. Undecided as of yet which reservation I'm going to be serving, but that has always been kind of at the heart of my experience. So I just want to say that I think I'm hopefully a success story of our program, and I hope that you keep us in your thoughts when you consider our funding. And again, thank you very much for your time, and I think if anyone has any questions, Dr. Mackin would be happy to take those.
Questions or comments from the committee? Well, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate
for the privilege
the
and all your good work, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have Catherine Vandenbosch, Christopher Kramer, and Gary Obermiller from the University of Minnesota Faculty Association. Two more.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Vandenbosch, and together with Dr. Chris Kramer, we're here to represent the faculty at the University of Minnesota, and Mr. Obermiller is an alumnus. I am grateful for the opportunity to address you today, especially to bring a perspective from faculty to the committee. And today I would especially like to talk about the context of how our world-class research university enriches our educational and outreach missions. I'm a biologist. I'm a faculty member, and I also lead a Department of Plant Sciences on the St. Paul campus. And this past decade has seen unprecedented advances in the field of biology, largely due to our ability to decode information from DNA from all kinds of species, from humans to crops. And continuing progress requires interactions of biological researchers with other scientists, including in math, chemistry, and computing in particular. At the University of Minnesota, we have strengths in all of these areas. And also, with an academic health center and a College of Agriculture, we're not only novel within the state of Minnesota, but we are among a very few institutions countrywide that can do biological sciences from soup to nuts, I would say. So how does our research expertise affect how we do our work? Well, faculty are all multitaskers, so they bring the vitality of discovery to their other activities. And I wanted to bring you two examples. Today's discoveries are in the classroom now. As a department head, I'm keenly aware of our investments in faculty. And yesterday, two young faculty members were in my office to talk about priorities for the next decade. These two not only compete successfully for extramural funding from the National Science Foundation and elsewhere to do their work on corn genetics and other topics, they are also in the classroom to provide a first-hand interpretation of information that is not even in textbooks yet. When talking to my two colleagues about their priorities for the coming years, they stressed the importance of strong teaching ability. These two give our students hands-on experience in research, and they and their colleagues are committed to make recent discoveries real to the students who will go on into areas such as the health professions, biotechnology, and agricultural sciences such as crop breeding and other areas. Another example comes from the translation of research for application and public outreach, which is another aspect of our educational mission. Agricultural research translates to new products such as new varieties of fruit and grains, and also to new processes such as techniques to deal with emerging diseases of crops and animals. These researchers are also educators. After developing a new product or practice, faculty reach all parts of the state to assure that the advances have an impact on the people that can use them. Without our research base, we'd have to be content with addressing new challenges with old knowledge. To take a step back, Minnesota is really blessed with a diversity of opportunities in higher education for our students, from renowned private colleges to state universities and technical colleges that are not only important to the to the workforce, but also to their communities, as we've recently heard, to the University of Minnesota, a comprehensive research university that trains the next generation in a host of areas requiring new knowledge and advanced training. On a personal note, I feel that my family has had an opportunity to appreciate the diversity of educational opportunities. 35 years ago, a small private college was the right choice for me to get my start in higher education. But my college-age children have made different choices. One used community college as a stepping stone to study engineering at a public university, and while the other, I'm proud to say, it entered directly into the University of Minnesota to prepare for her goal of a career in genetics. In summary, I want to stress that students differ in their needs and preferences based on their goals and commitments, and that the University of Minnesota provides a unique opportunity within the state of Minnesota. And secondly, our state's population benefits from our research mission and our educational outreach. Therefore, I want to encourage you to honor the diverse needs of the state's students by maintaining a balance of support for our two great public systems of higher education in the state of Minnesota. Please renew your commitment to supporting the University of Minnesota to assure that coming generations have the choice and access to education based on new knowledge from current research. Thank you, and after my colleagues' comments, I'd be happy to take any comments or questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Dr. Kramer?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the faculty of the University of Minnesota. My name is Chris Kramer. My field is chemistry. I work in the college in science and engineering, where I've been since leaving active duty military service as a Desert Storm veteran in 1992. So many of you probably studied chemistry in high school, and you loved it, I feel certain. Right? Oh, you're asking questions. It's a very old subject. It's been taught for about 200 years. But if you compare today's textbooks to those from years ago, the new ones are different. They are packed with new knowledge, and in particular with knowledge that's critical for today's students to understand in order to better compete in our 21st century high technology economy. That new knowledge came from research. New knowledge, new technologies, I can talk about chemistry, food that stays fresh longer, post-it notes that stick better, biodegradable packaging materials, sensors at the airport that detect explosive traces, all of those came from research. And another word for the development of new things is innovation. The University of Minnesota is the state's innovation university. So innovation and research are admittedly expensive, but they're also critically important to a dynamic and a competitive state. Just as the most successful manufacturing firms simultaneously run both production and research and development operations, so too Minnesota should recognize that its two university systems offer a balanced and diversified portfolio of solid training in today's knowledge together with development of tomorrow's knowledge. The undergraduate and graduate students who've worked in my research group, that is, those students that I teach every day both in and outside the traditional classroom, have the opportunity to employ the most advanced instrumentation, computers, laboratory equipment in their studies, in part because of the investment the people of the state of Minnesota have made in the university. After graduation, my students have gone on to work in pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies, personal care product companies, software companies, semiconductor manufacturing, to name a few places. Many have used the skills they learned at the U to generate and patent intellectual property. In summary, I want to emphasize that sometimes higher education occurs in the classroom, sometimes in a lab, sometimes in the field, and investing in the resources required to keep that educational experience at the cutting edge does require dollars, but the dividends from such investment make it worthwhile, both for the students themselves and the state. So thank you for the opportunity to appear before you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Obermiller.
My name is Gary Obermiller. First of all, I think we all had that dream where you were in school, or I should say nightmare. You were in school and you hadn't studied for a test. Well, with all the educators I see around me today, I feel as though I haven't studied for some test someplace. So, I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota. I'm a product of the education system of Minnesota. I went to St. John's University, University of Minnesota. I have a degree in mechanical engineering, and I have an MBA from the University of St. Thomas. My experience is all with Minnesota companies. I'm currently the managing director of Mill City Capital, which is a Minneapolis private equity firm. I previously was the CEO of Delta Corporation, which was a $500 million public company involved in the power generation business. And I was the COO of Econotherm Energy Systems Corporation, which is also in the oil, gas, and power industry business, and I also work for Graco. I wanted to talk to you today about some specific examples of how I've been involved with the University of Minnesota in developing new products, continuing the employment of Minnesotans, and actually growing businesses here. I'm sure many of you have been involved in the wind and solar alternative power industries. Those industries are really great, but we all know that they don't work when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. When that doesn't happen, almost all of them will have backup power from combined cycle natural gas-driven power plants. They're driven with jet engines. Back in 1985, when I was the COO of Econotherm Energy Systems, we were involved in the first of those gas turbine power plants. We made the very large waste heat boilers. Because of the extreme flow from the jet engines, like an airplane jet engine, which it is, we had a lot of very unique designs that we had to do. I enlisted the aid of the University of Minnesota, the heat transfer department, and the fluid mechanics department to flow model test those types of designs for about a six-month period. We developed a new product which is still in use today. So anytime you see a gas turbine power plant, which you probably will see more than you realize, is because of the University of Minnesota and that work that was done back then. I took that design along with other work that was done at the university in their heat transfer department and developed the similar kind of product line with Deltac Corporation. Deltac became the world's largest supplier of gas turbine HRSGs, which is, in fact, the power plant of choice in China, other than coal, in China, all of Asia, and a good part of Europe. So the technology developed in both heat transfer design and also airflow design at the university is powering power plants around the world and, in fact, employing a lot of Minnesotans. At the time I ran Deltac, we had about 220 engineers. Almost all of them came from the University of Minnesota because of the expertise in heat transfer and fluid mechanics. One other anecdote. I'm currently the chairman of Remley Engineering, which is a company we own. Remley is a Minnesota-based company with four manufacturing plants in Big Lake, Coon Rapids, and also New Brighton. And it's about a $125 million business. Half of the business is in aerospace and defense. The other half is in medical products. In the aerospace and defense side, Remley is involved in the the machining of very large components used in radar systems for land-based and marine-based systems. All the land-based systems and most of the ship-based systems are made by Ramley Engineering here in Minnesota. And the reason they are is that we did heat transfer design again with the University of Minnesota and developed specific patentable products which Ramley has today, which cause us to be the sole supplier of that type of equipment. Ramley today employs 550 people. We have about 92 engineers, and it really has a real significant play in the world of Minnesota. So I guess I wanted to say that I believe that the work that the University of Minnesota does, specifically in the research area, the lab area, are very important for Minnesota companies, are one of the reasons why I can, you know, plan on keeping our businesses here.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions from the committee? Thank you all very much for being here today. Next on the list, we have Elaine Keefe and Karen Bronstein with the Minnesota Library Association. So thank you both for being here. If you can, whenever you're ready, and just identify yourself for the record.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association. And I want to talk to you about funding for Minitech's library services and also for the MinLink Gateway. And those are two line items that are in the Office of Higher Education budget. And they both provide vital services to all of our higher education libraries. We know that everybody has to sacrifice in these tight budget times, but I would urge you to minimize the cuts to these two programs as much as possible. MinLink is the statewide online library catalog that allows library users to search library catalogs throughout the state and to borrow materials from any participating library. Interlibrary loan requests submitted to MinLink have soared by 55% in the past 5 years, and we expect that rate of growth to continue. Your efforts to minimize cuts to MinLink would be greatly appreciated. This is a way that we help stretch all of our library dollars. I'm going to focus the bulk of my testimony, though, on Minitech's, and that's because there's a significant difference between the House and Senate bills. The Senate cut to Minitech's is almost twice as large as that proposed by the House. And if I could leave you with one key message today, it would be this: Minitech's saves money. How does Minitech's do this? Well, there are a variety of ways. First of all, Minitech's purchases subscriptions to online electronic databases of scholarly journals, periodicals, and other reference materials through a service called the Electronic Library for Minnesota. These statewide subscriptions that Minitech's purchases cost far less than they would if each individual library subscribed on their own. These statewide subscriptions also serve as a great equalizer, so that if you're a library user, you have access to a basic set of electronic databases regardless of where you are. Minitech's also negotiates discounts on subscriptions to more specialized materials that are not needed in every single library, but that individual higher ed libraries can then subscribe to if they choose to at a much discounted rate compared to if they just went and subscribed on their own. This centralized negotiation that Minitech's conducts saves our libraries a lot of money. Minitech's also delivers the materials that are ordered through the MinLink system for interlibrary loan. I mean, it's one thing to look online and see the individual items in the catalog and to request them. It's another to actually have them delivered from library to library. And this sharing of library materials really helps us to stretch our dollars. It means that you have access to the collections, not just of the library that you're in physically, but of libraries throughout the state. And it means that not everyone has to own everything. And that results in a big, big savings. Without the services of Minitech's, our libraries would spend more and they would get a lot less. And so access to important research materials for both students and faculty really would be diminished. We really depend on both Minitech's and MinLink. So we would ask you to please do what you can to minimize the cuts to Minitech's and MinLink as you make these tough decisions in the next few weeks. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bronstein?
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Bronstein, and I'm the librarian at Anoka Technical College, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Minitech's program. expanding on some of the things that Elaine said, I want to put into context what Minutech services do for a small academic library. Anoka Technical College has approximately 1,800 FYE students, but if you count them individually, it's about 5,000 students, and they all have information needs by virtue of being enrolled in college or training programs. But due to the high cost of instruction in a technical college, the library squeaks by with a staff of 2 and an annual materials budget of $22,000. Minutech has calculated that just the academic databases that my small college uses would have cost us $120,000 for a single-year subscription. They've calculated that for Minsky libraries collectively, the cost savings equal $12.9 million. The Electronic Library for Minnesota enables Minnesota library users with a barcode to gain immediate access to quality academic resources that are otherwise locked from internet traffic. And for the cost of just printing, a student walks away with information, in many cases an article or several, from a scholarly journal or a trade publication fulfilling the parameters of an assignment. Now, the assignments are not going to go away even if we lose access to databases, making it difficult for students to find information or ascertain its credibility. A subscription database, when purchased at the individual academic library level, is priced based on FTE. For a college even the modest size of Anoka Tech, a database can still cost upwards of $5,000 a year. And remember the amount of funding we have to work with, approximately $22,000. How many databases could we possibly purchase access to? Even if a library did have a large amount of money to work with and subscribed independently, it would be an ineffectively negotiated price because the statewide purchasing power is lost. We'd be faced with the reality of foregoing access to information or overpaying, also with taxpayer money, at the sacrifice of other necessary resources. Either reality places students at an academic risk. And in the two-year college, they are so close to getting back into the workforce that it's truly expensive to our economy when they do not complete their goals. 16% of Anoka Tech students entered college with low-level reading comprehension, and we are enrolling increasing numbers of displaced workers with anxiety and self-esteem problems due to a large gap out of school. Getting these students to better vetted information faster helps them to complete courses required for graduation. Let me give you a specific example of one of our students studying to become a medical assistant. Jenny came to our library technician 2 weeks before the end of last semester, near tears, due to the stress of juggling work, college, and pregnancy. She did not have internet access at home, many don't, and she had used all of her spare time on campus trying to find information with Google. Wading through massive amounts of information but finding none suitable, and with her deadline approaching, she was losing hope in passing English composition, a required course. But we were able to use the Electronic Library of Minnesota databases to print her several quality articles in less than 5 minutes. She returned before the end of the semester to thank us and report that she received an A on her paper. Not bad after contemplating failure. Our library purchases access to the authoritative full-text database in the field of nursing for only $1,300 a year. And this is a vital resource because nursing students have to find information that is less than 3 years old, and it has to be from a nursing journal. This vital resource, if we were to purchase it on our own without the assistance of Minitex's cooperative purchasing, would cost us almost $15,000. Libraries have been savvy to the concept of stretching and sharing resources for decades. The least expensive way to provide access to information is through a consortium. The most expensive way is libraries individually. It's Minitex that's made it possible for students of even the smallest colleges to gain access to the information they need to succeed. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here today. Thank you. Next, we have Don Larson and Russ Stanton.
Good afternoon, Chair Fischbach, Chair Nornes, Senators, Representatives. For the record, I'm Don Larson. I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State University Mankato in the English Department, but I'm currently serving as the president of the Interfaculty Organization, which represents the faculty at the 7 state universities of the Minsky system. And I'm here with our Director of Government Relations, Russ Stanton. I'll let Russ introduce himself.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. I would like to speak basically to the tuition portion or the tuition cap issue, and then turn things over to Don to speak to other concerns that we have with the bill. The interfaculty organization supports the MNSCU Board of Trustees position on tuition caps. We oppose tuition caps, and if you're going to do tuition caps, we'd certainly not want to have tuition caps set at anything below 5% for the students. If the state of Minnesota had kept up its financial commitment to higher education, we would be among the loudest voices for low tuition. We certainly were in the past. But I went back and I looked, and in our peak in fiscal year 2009, the legislature passed an appropriation bill that appropriated $689 million for MNSCU for fiscal 2009. Since that time, it's been whittled down by unallotments and by cuts and so forth, to the point we're at $605.5 million this year. And if you look at the Senate bill, it would take us down to $546 million roughly. The House bill, $528 million. Those are just enormous, enormous cuts that we have sustained in appropriation. And we've simply had to rely on tuition to do some backfilling, and we'll have to continue to do that. We as faculty have done what we can to try to contain costs and keep our institutions affordable. If you look at instructional costs at the state universities, you can look at their dashboard website. Our instructional costs are in the lowest 10 percentile of for comparable institutions nationally. We've supported tuition for, pay freezes. We've been supportive of reorganization efforts that have been quite painful. I mean, it's amounted to hundreds of positions within our units. In order to try to keep our costs down. A lot has been made about tuition costs, particularly at our two-year institutions. I have passed out a printout of what the tuition is at each of the institutions in Minnesota. And it is true that our tuition in Minnesota, particularly for the 2 years, ranks very high when you compare it to comparable institutions nationally. However, we'd also like to point out from a different perspective that the two-year students have by far the lowest tuition of any students within the state of Minnesota. Two-year students at MNSCU pay about $4,900 a year in tuition and fees. That's about one-third of what the private college two-year students pay in Minnesota. That's about 20 to 25% less than what a state university student would pay. And keep in mind, English 101 at a community college transfers to English 101 at a state university. And it's at a much lower price at a community college. Their tuition is about one half of what the U of M students pay, so you know, quite frankly, students do have still a very good financial deal in Minnesota, even though when compared to other states, their tuition is high. And while our tuition is high in Minnesota, I think you need to also take into account one other factor, and that is that we have one of the most generous financial aid programs in the state of Minnesota of any state in the nation, and that at least offsets some of the high tuition for the lowest income students. We believe that we have a Board of Trustees. One of their primary duties is to do the trade-offs between tuition costs and maintaining quality, and we believe that they should be able to do their job without being micromanaged. They have a very extensive consultation process with the students, the student senates, when they set tuition. We believe that process should be allowed to work, and so therefore We would suggest that we not have tuition caps or at maximum. We followed the board's recommendation of not more than 5%. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Following up on what Russ said, you heard Russ echoing several points that Chancellor McCormick made in his testimony as well. And on behalf of the IFO, I can say that we support the goals and the priorities that the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor's Office has put forward in terms of the budget, in terms of the issues of policy language that Chancellor McCormick also mentioned somewhat earlier. Obviously, we want to see something improvement ultimately in what looks like the likely targets for the system appropriation. As you probably know, and as I believe Chancellor McCormick pointed out, we are talking about an appropriation here that would reduce us to 1998 spending levels while in a system that's educating 40,000 more students. Policy issues that Chancellor McCormick mentioned, which would include the issue of tuition caps, we also believe are matters that are best left to the Board of Trustees and to the system in consultation with the students, with the faculty, with the staff, with the communities that our institutions serve, to find the best way rather than operate by a legislative fiat that, with all due respect, is all too often a blunt hammer, a blunt instrument in trying to achieve certain goals for a very complex set of topics in a very large and very complex organization. Just to mention a couple of policy issues that we believe deserve attention in terms of the difficulties they raise and the potential harm they may do. In the House version of the bill, the set-aside of 1% for so-called performance improvements would wind up sequestering 1% of the operating budget for our institutions for at least a year. So rather than having that money available as some kind of prize to be won after achieving certain goals, it rather ties the hands of our institutions in terms of what they can do with that 1% of dollars that are coming into them. And 1% doesn't sound like much as a percentage in terms of actual dollars. It's a great amount. And also, you might be surprised to know that the IFO does not support the language in the House bill in lines 13.1 and 14.5 that would require the chancellor's salary to be held at or below that of the governor. The governor's salary is a political instrument, whether Republican, Democrat, or independent. It is used by politicians of all parties as a kind of measure and as a kind of blunt appeal to the populace when we're dealing with looking for the best qualified individuals to work within a system, whether they're faculty or administrators or staff. We do not believe that, again, legislative fiats tying those contract negotiations to a particular dollar figure are the way to go. As you may know, Dr. McCormick's successor has already signed a contract that holds him to the same line that the chancellor currently has. We also, as Chancellor McCormick mentioned, oppose the language on credit transfer that's in both languages of the bill. As the chancellor mentioned, there are already processes at work as we speak to improve transfer within the system, in a system where it already works quite well. I've testified before, at least one of your committees before, about the student survey that was conducted at the end of the last academic year, which demonstrated that over 90% of the transfers within the system are in fact successful, and that a large portion of the apparently unsuccessful ones are actually due to a lack of students seeking advising or getting inappropriate advising for how to transfer, how to plan to transfer their credits, and also being unaware of the appeals process. There are already actions in place to try to improve that advising situation. In addition, there's a new program that's currently at work as a result of changes in board policy called Smart Transfer that, in my opinion, is actually going to have the potential to make the Minscu system and the and Minnesota a model for the rest of the country in talking about matters of how one uses student learning outcomes and how to facilitate transfer in a meaningful way that actually advances students' education and assures the quality of what our institutions are providing. I'm going to end on a personal point that's related to the two sheets I asked to be distributed before you. Unlike many of the people who have spoken here today and many others in this room, I'm not a native-born Minnesota. I'm a New Englander by birth. My wife is from New York. But we have chosen to remain in Minnesota despite the weather, despite the other drawbacks that some people might perceive, for three decades now. It's where we are going to retire. It's where I expect that we will die. And why should we do that? It's because of Minnesota's quality of life, a quality of life that has been strongly, strongly tied to its educational quality, to the research incentives that the representatives from the University of Minnesota talked about, to a highly educated student body in our VOTEX, in our community colleges, in our state universities, and at the U, at our private colleges, too. But when I look at the data on those two sheets in front of you, I worry. On the white sheet is the page for Minnesota from that study from Georgetown, which calculated what the needs for higher education are going to be in all 50 states by the year 2018. As you may recall, Minnesota is third from the top in terms of students who will need to graduate with some degree of higher education as they go into the workforce. I'd also point out the fourth bullet point on the left. Minnesota is going to be the fifth in the nation in needing some form of baccalaureate education as well. But then look at the yellow sheet in the right-hand column, per capita state and local government expenditures. Minnesota used to be at or near the top of that ladder. We're now number 28. Contrary to Garrison Keillor, we're now below average, and we're falling, and that worries me. One of my functions is to serve as a peer reviewer for the Higher Learning Commission, which accredits all higher education institutions from West Virginia to Arizona. And I recently went on a team visit for a reaccreditation to a university within one of those states that are 27 above us, a state that we sometimes like to sneer at and draw a comparison to ourselves, smugly feeling that Minnesota is so much more great than that particular state. And I saw a university that was doing pretty well, not flush with cash by any means, and with its problems like we all have, but one that had a firm direction, most of all had support from its state for its mission and for its students. And I'm saying, what is that state doing above Minnesota? How much further is it going to climb above Minnesota? How much lower are we going to sink? I'm very worried. As a citizen, as a taxpayer, I am worried. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Next we have on the list Marvin Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. If you could just start when you're ready and identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for your time today. For the record, my name is Marvin Taylor, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, where I'm completing a PhD in geography at the present, and my research focuses on historical and economic development of Minnesota in the 20th century. So I'm not going to talk to you today about my research. Instead, I want to cast a broader perspective on education as somebody who's come through the Minnesota system from small high school to university, and now looking to teach in either the University of Minnesota or Minscu systems. 15 years ago, I was a junior in high school at Lanesboro, southeast Minnesota, down near where Representative Davids comes from, anxious to leave Lanesboro, as many small town kids do. College was the obvious choice, but the prospect of paying for college even then was intimidating. Annual tuition at the University of Minnesota would go over $4,000 in the upcoming academic year. For me, this was actually, in retrospect, it's hard to believe. I was scared about that, but it led me to enlist a week after my 17th birthday. I enlisted in the National Guard, a junior in high school. This was my plan to pay for my college. My dad Vietnam veteran said, you know, you don't need to do that to go to college. You don't need to do that, because he feared what would actually, how the world might change. But I did it. The educational benefits were good. Spent the summer before my senior year at Fort Benning. Only my second time flying on an airplane. It was the furthest I'd ever been away from home at that time. This morning, I stood before about 80 undergraduates at the University of Minnesota. I'm an instructor for Population and Interacting World in the Geography Department at the university. Today's lecture focused upon recent immigration to Minnesota. A handful of the students were immigrants themselves, from Liberia, Somalia, China, and even Australia. Leaving Lanesboro, leaving Monrovia, leaving Mogadishu, we search, we set forth. Sometimes we are guided by dreams, sometimes we are impelled by necessity. Since I was a 17-year-old enlisting, the military tuition at the University of Minnesota has jumped from under $4,000 per year to over $11,000 per year. If your bill is enacted, the state contribution will be flat during the same period. If I was a 17-year-old in Lanesboro today, I am quite frankly not sure what I would do. 15 years after enlisting, with 3 years off from school, half spent on active duty, I'm nearing the completion of my PhD in geography. It's been a long road. I just applied for my first academic position last week, a position at a Minsky university that will go unnamed. But considering this position has made me further wonder where we are headed. Excitement about the prospect of applying gave way to a more subdued consideration. The position is for a 4-4 appointment, four classes teaching in the fall, four in the spring. It's a fixed-term position, so I wouldn't have a 10-year track or anything like that. If I had this schedule, I would be concerned that it would, quite frankly, negatively impact my teaching and my research. And I just want to put this in perspective. We talk about cuts. I'm looking at this from a junior faculty standpoint in my time, my ability to teach my students. The scheduled time for the courses totals slightly over 10 hours per week. That's actual in-class time. Doesn't sound like that much, but with the courses meeting at 9 different times, I just crudely estimate about 2 hours would be coming and going to arrive before class, to deliver, to start on time, to hang out a little bit after class, talk with students. 12 hours we are totaled. With 118 students currently enrolled in the four courses, I figured it would be a lot, about 2 hours per student for the whole semester for grading. If I did that, 2 hours per student, I think that includes exams, papers, quizzes, entering grades, that'd be about 15 hours a week averaged out over the course of a semester. The courses fill the capacity, as they often are right now with the shortages, it would be about 17 and a half hours per week. With only 2 hours of grading per student, I would need to rely upon multiple choice exams. The number of assignments, especially written assignments, would need to be kept at a minimum. For office hours and email with students, I decided a lot about 3 hours a week if I can do a job like this. That is woefully under adequate, about 1.5 minutes per student per week. Teaching three different courses each week, I would need to prepare about 7.5 hours of new material each week. That includes one of the courses is taught twice, so I'm not including that in 7.5 hours. As a junior faculty, potential junior faculty, that is a daunting task. With 2 hours of prep for each hour of new material, I would need about 15 hours a week. This is far less than what I'm currently devoting to my lectures at the University of Minnesota. A lot of little time for general administrative duties, maybe 2 hours a week. Oh yes, I'm supposed to also seek to research as well. Research is important even at, you know, in the Minsky system, so I allotted myself about 10 hours per week in my estimate of how much time this might take, recognizing that over our breaks, we have opportunity to do more research. So what does this all add up to? This is a really rough calculation, but about 55 hours per week. And what troubles me is not the fact that I might be working 55 hours per week or the pay that I would be paid at, but that this would be an underwhelming experience for all involved. Working hard for mediocrity is not a sustainable path. It'll wear out the teachers. It'll wear out the students. I know I can be an effective teacher. I am not sure the state is willing to support institutions at this point that enable the effective teaching that we need. A simple answer is to diminish the importance of research in favor of teaching.
related to this, support for undergraduates can be emphasized. I sense that both of these sentiments have entered your bills as I've read them. The House bill seeks to preserve grants for high school graduates. The Senate bill seeks to minimize cuts to the Minsky system relative to the University of Minnesota. Likewise, limiting tuition increases for resident undergraduates is a stated objective in both legislative pieces. These are noble aims. And having come from the state, I appreciate those efforts. But I'm concerned that there's a sad truth that the affordability of public higher education has already been undermined over the last two decades. What I see as threatened now is not just the affordability of higher education, but the quality of higher education. This quality requires strong institutions and high morale. It requires research and advanced classes in a wide range of fields. It requires time and it requires resources. I don't see us at a tipping point as others maybe do right now in higher education. I see it more as a grinding down of higher education into what I might call medium education. Perhaps in the future we'll have medium education committees here in the House, in the Senate. There will not be an imminent crisis. Faculty will not likely flood to other states, if only because other states are pursuing similar courses. I am saddened lately by discussion with one of my committee members. He is on my dissertation committee. He is, in my view, one of the greatest scholars in all of academic and geography today, not just at University of Minnesota, but throughout the world. And in our conversations, on more than one occasion this semester, he has looked at me, and we've shared this conversation, and he just says, I don't have time to think. And so here it is. I have to look at one of my professors, a brilliant scholar who works routinely into the wee hours of the morning, looking me in the eye and telling me he does not have time to think. I don't know where we're going. I'm not sure exactly what we're doing. And I know that this isn't the first time the state has faced budget issues. I studied Minnesota in the 1920s, the 30s, and into the 40s. In 1932, when University of Minnesota President Lotus Kaufman addressed the relationship of education to the Depression, in simple terms, he stated, budget making in a depression becomes a test of what we really believe in. And I think that's what we need to find, is what we really believe in these times. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming down. We've got one more person signed up, and then we were going to have a couple of questions, but we have about 10 minutes left, so I will go ahead and call on Mr. Spaeth. Thank you very much, Chair.
Committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Andrew Spaeth. I'm a student at Bemidji State University, and I also serve as the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, MSUSA, which represents 75,000 students attending the seven state universities in the Minsky system. I just want to thank the leadership for your work in this process and for your future work as you negotiate a package to send to the governor. As all of you know, the state universities are an important asset to Minnesota's economy. Literally thousands of people from communities all across the state attend a Minsky institution each year. These schools are a point of access for an affordable higher education. And now more than ever, our state relies on Minsky schools to retrain and retool our workforce for the 21st century. The system is producing nearly 35,000 graduates each year and helping Minnesota remain economically competitive. Throughout this session, I have testified on numerous occasions about the importance of funding the Minsky system. I'd like to offer our continued support for the highest possible appropriation available. Minsky schools are chosen by people because of their accessibility and affordability, while at the same time offering high quality programs. In times like these, when tough decisions have to be made, the state should refocus its efforts on our core functions. Universities are assets that require full partnership in order to remain successful. With that said, I'd like to briefly comment on the priority placed on full funding for the state grant program in the House proposal. Our students appreciate these efforts. However, we believe that at this time the state needs to focus on the core functions of our state as well as the MNSCU system. By shifting the dollars in the state grant program while cutting MNSCU, we're sacrificing the core function that MNSCU provides. As you may have heard before, the best financial aid is low tuition. By placing more money in the MNSCU system for our schools, we can help keep tuition rates low, and taxpayer dollars will be spent on a system that was created to be affordable and accessible to all citizens. Only 40% of state grant program dollars go to MNSCU students, while 100% of MNSCU operations and maintenance budget benefits our students. MSUSA has submitted a letter in support of a 5% tuition cap at the state universities. MSUSA believes that a 5% cap will protect the services and courses offered to students. Both proposals have the universities at a 4% cap. And although 1% may not seem like much, it is the difference between courses being offered or closed and many other things that are vital to the success of students. A higher state appropriation could limit tuition increases below 5%. But with these proposals, in order to maintain quality educational opportunities, students and their families must bear the burden of the state's unwillingness to invest in our future. MSUSA recently completed a student financial literacy survey. And while the findings were really not all that shocking to our students or our recent alumni, they may be somewhat shocking to a person that has not recently attended a higher education institution. Over 365 current students submitted responses to the survey and really told us what we've expected all along. Students that are saddled with more and more debt are delaying things in life that are staples to your generation's success and the success of our economy in the past. 37% said they would need to delay getting married and starting a family. 40% expect to be long-term renters instead of purchasing a home. 37% will delay buying a car. 47% have delayed plans to attend graduate school. All of these due to the burden of repaying their student loans. The over 365 students that responded to our survey were all current students at a MNSCU institution, which is supposed to be the most affordable and accessible option when choosing a university, and which is currently in our state. Students are accumulating this debt while working full or part-time. Over 85% of the students that completed the survey were working. Our students greatly appreciate that both bodies chose not to cut work study and the child care grant program. Many of our students rely on these programs to successfully finish their degree. The language in Section 16 of the House could unintentionally hurt some of our students. MSUSA has worked with MNSCU over the last few years to enhance the transfer system. We feel very confident that the changes recommended in the study presented by Associate Vice Chancellor Lopez will greatly reduce the burden on students and create a streamlined process for transferring within the MNSCU system. Again, we thank the committee for hearing our testimony on the bill today. We'll be available to answer any questions throughout the process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of want to break the mold here. I just want to ask Mr. Spaeth a quick question. Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Spaeth, you indicated that the students, the MSUSA students, were in favor of raising the cap according to, different than what the House and the Senate have at the 4%, up to a 5%, a self-imposed sort of increase in their tuition from what's being offered. Was that done by survey? Was it done by unanimous acclamation? How did you come about that conclusion that all the students were in favor of that?
Mr. Spaeth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson. So the Minnesota State University Student Association has 7 institutions which are included in it. And so each of our institutions is represented on a board of directors by their student body president, which are elected by the students at their respective institutions. So, for example, the student body president at St. Cloud State University serves on our board, as well as the other 6 institutions. And so our board of directors came together and made a decision that up to a 5% increase in tuition was acceptable based on the current state appropriation in the House and Senate.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that was an action by your board, not necessarily a survey of all the students.
Mr. Spaeth.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, you are correct.
Thank you.
And I will just say, members, there was some confusion. I thought we had till 2:30. SEA thought we had till 2:20, but I guess we really only had till 2:15. So we have gone over our time. So thank you very much, Mr. Spaeth. And I will just say that Representative Nornes will call us the next time we are going to meet. He'll let us know. And if everybody could just move out as quickly as possible, we've overstayed our welcome here at the Senate base or the House hearing room. Thank you very much.